alright, so I'm being foolish. Well, alright, let people know about the dreams and wishes you wish in the night when lights are low.
Welcome to Between the Covers, a weekly KBOO program all about books and the people who write them. I'm your host this week, Ken Jones. On today's show, our guest is Kimberly King Parsons, author of the story collection Black Light from Vintage Books. Kim's fiction has been published in the Paris Review, Best Small Fictions 2017, Black Warrior Review, No Tokens, Kenyon Review, and other journals, and her book reviews and interviews have appeared in Book Forum, Fanzine, Time Out New York, and The Millions. Black Light is Kim's first published book, and it was recently long-listed for the 2019 National Book Award. Her novel, The Boiling River, about Texas, motherhood, and LSD, is forthcoming from Knopf. Kim was born in Lubbock, Texas, the birthplace of Buddy Holly, and now lives here in Portland. Amy Hempel said of Black Light, "The badass gals in these terrific stories are all attitude, and as funny and appealing in their imperfection and thwarted desire as you'll find in any fiction out there. Parsons opens and ends stories brilliantly. I just finished this book, and I'm going to read it again right away." Kimberly King Parsons, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you so much for having me. It's such a pleasure to be here.
Now, Kim, you've said that you worked on the stories in this book from 2005. That's when you started the MFA program at Columbia, up until 2017. And they were written not as a link collection, at least not consciously. And I saw one of your events at the recent Portland Book Festival. Someone asked you what unified the stories. You answered, Texas, scrappy resiliency, and intensity of voice, which is all very evident in the book, and we'll get to those connections. But first, let's just look at a few of the story titles themselves. Glow Hunter, The Light Will Pour In, Starlight, and the title story, Black Light. Was that motif of light something you were aware of when writing these individual stories?
I think obviously when you're putting those titles together, you have the moment to say, do I want to show these links or do I want to hide them? And so, you know, we didn't have to call it, we could have changed some of the titles to make them not be so light heavy. but I think the motifs were already there, and they were there even when I wasn't consciously putting them there. They just kept cropping up anyway. And then when originally the book, we didn't have this title. This wasn't the title. And my agent and I sort of happened upon this, that we were tossing around the idea of the title Unseen in Natural Light, which I liked, but Natural Light is a beer, and I kept thinking about beer every time I would see it. And there's something a little bit, maybe a little pretentious or precious about that, Unseen in Natural Light. But then I thought, Black Light does the same thing, right? We all know what a black light does. And then I realized that that could be something that would work for the collection. And then we realized the Story Fellowship, which is what the Unseen and Natural Light line comes from anyway, has this scene with the black light bowling alley. And so we thought this is a great way to tie it all together. And then when we were going through and looking at retitling some of the stories, it all just sort of made sense in that way. So.
Now, the book's epigraph is from a poem by Richard Sykin, from his book Crush. The epigraph goes, "Cut me open and the light streams out." I looked up the poem. The next line is, "Stitch me up and the light keeps streaming out between the stitches." Why did you pick this line to start the book? Again, it's that motif of light.
It's the motif of light. It's also that Sykin poem is sort of has all of the same gritty, grimy elements. You know, it's about 2 men in a hotel room, a motel room, not a hotel room. There's a big difference. the sort of brutal love that's happening between them. And I've always, that poem is something I sort of carry around in my head all the time. And when we were thinking of epigraphs, it sort of encompasses all of my favorite things about my book, which is just that sort of that same, the light coming through, there's no way to stop the light from coming through. So even in that brutal violence, even in the cut me open, there's still going to be the light. And the second line, especially too, with the stitches, something about that's just always resonated with me.
You get the idea. It's kind of a vital life force, that
yeah.
light. And whatever the two men are thinking or doing there, it's a positive in a way. Yeah. even with the cut me open line, it's the brutal part.
It's what are we willing to do to connect with other people? I mean, there's a line in Carol Masso has a book called The Art Lover, and there's a line where the daughter wants to connect with her father, and she talks about wanting to gnaw off her arm to be able to better hug him. Something like that, right? Like these things that we're willing to do to sort of almost sacrifice your own body to connect with somebody else, to get to that intimacy. And so those men are doing that in that story. But I feel like a lot of my characters are trying to do that as well.
Oh, definitely. And the references to light are not just in the epigraph and a few story titles. In the first line of the very first piece in the book, and that's Guts, is the story. You write, "When I start dating Tim, an almost doctor, all the sick, broken people in the world begin to glow." And then the third story in the book, Glow Hunter, begins with this line, "Bo's more brightly lit than the rest of us." What is this light that's coming out of the characters? Is that kind of life force and that attempt to connect with others?
Yeah, I think there are two different types of light there. So in Guts, I think it's the light of revelation, or it's suddenly these things that she didn't see that were there all along are being illuminated in this way. And later in that same paragraph, she's like, all these people used to be sort of gross and disgusting, and now I see them as radiant, and they're just needy. They just need so much. And that's maybe a different type of light than what Bo has, which is just that light of pure charisma, which is something that is so fascinating to me in general, just charisma. The idea that there are some people we want to look at, we want to watch them get out of a car, or in that paragraph, people stop to watch her shake sugar into her tea, like, because there's just something about them. They are magnetic and compelling, and it's about the light hits them differently, something about them. And so the narrator of that story is not a charismatic narrator, but she's so drawn to Bo because she is. And the whole point about it is that it's not quantifiable. You just can't explain it.
Now, here's a different use of light, and this is in the story titled The Light Will Pour In, rather than kind of emanate. And the characters there, the narrator's an older, out-of-shape guy with a much younger lover. It's kind of almost a Lolita type scenario. They appear to be on the run, and they're stopping for the night in a motel with an M in Dallas, and it's a fairly depressing Dallas motel room. What's the significance of the light pouring in rather than coming from the character themselves, as in those previous stories like Guts and Glow Hunter?
I think for that story, it's these people who have left behind their marriages or whatever obligations they had back in their other town, and they've been in this sort of weird cycle of being on like different buses, and they're on the run, and this idea of having an empty vessel, and now they're empty and they're together and they're waiting for something to fill it and they're waiting for it to make sense to them. So sort of almost that hopeful moment of like, the light will pour in, right? It's gonna come, isn't it? Instead of, because I think they're feeling like we've left everything for this love, and was it worth it?
And they kind of get the idea, at least the narrator does, that bad things are just going to happen. And it's almost kind of a pipe dream to think that the light's going to pour in and save them.
Well, he says that he sees an image in his mind of like neon that burns with the words, let her go.
Let her go.
And he knows he needs to, but he's not. My characters are often very, they're really great at getting messages, but they're not so great at taking.
I actually have a question a little later about their self-awareness in the face of what many of us might be more delusional.
Sure.
But they're not really.
No.
Now, I want to get into some of the recurring things between the stories besides the motif of light. We mentioned Texas, your character's resiliency, and the importance of voice, the primary importance of voice in the stories. But first, I want to talk about how you even knew you had a publishable collection here. You gave credit to a writer-editor, Dawn Raffle. I'm pronouncing the last name
right.
And you said she was very encouraging when you showed her the manuscript, help you understand the friction between the individual stories and how they might work as a whole. Now, that kind of stuck with me, because what do you mean by friction as opposed to the relationships between the stories, the connections between the stories?
So for me, I always am looking for where things rub against each other, not necessarily in a in a good way, and almost like as an irritant, because that's compelling to me, is the friction. It's not the sort of seamlessness that I'm interested in. I'm interested in those fault lines between the things.
Oh, interesting, because you mentioned the word irritant, I think, at the book festival, how a story starts.
Yeah.
You said either as a refrain or an irritant.
Yeah.
And I wasn't quite sure what you meant by irritant. That friction between the story?
The friction, or just something that I can't let go. It's bothering me. And in a good way, right? It's my thoughts are returning to it. If you want to take the most obvious sort of irritant use would be like the idea of an oyster with a pearl, right? This little grain of sand, and then it just sits there and gets wrapped and wrapped and wrapped until it becomes a pearl, right? Yeah. But for Dawn Raffel is someone whose work I read as a very young person, and she had a book called In the Year of Long Division that is very weird and very dark, and a lot of child narrators, a lot of the sort of brutality of childhood and the cruelty of children, and also just children trying to find their place in their families.
You found a kindred spirit there.
I did. Well, and it was as my spirit was forming, perhaps, too, because I was a very young person. And I used to have a blog called The Long Division, because her story is called In the Year of Long Division. It was a very, you just find those things sometimes that stick with you. And so later, I was in New York, and I'd been living in New York for a long time, and we sort of had friends in common, and I realized she was doing editing, and I asked if I could send her my collection, to have her have a look. I didn't even know if it was a collection. I have a stack of stuff. Can I send it to you? And will you tell me, is it a collection? Like, what do you think of this? And so I did, and I just had these stories, and I thought, do these work? And she sort of said, one of them I don't think goes there. One of them, maybe like one or two of them didn't seem to work with the rest. And then she sort of shifted the order around a bit. But she was like, I do think this is a collection. To me, this seems like which is, of course, that was, I just needed a little bit of encouragement from someone who had written the type of collection that I wanted to write.
Did her sequencing of the stories make it to the final?
No.
Okay.
No. I mean,
but she got you on your way.
She did. And, so much happened at the end, because I added, maybe 12,000 words from the time that it was accepted by Vintage, even to the publication date. My way of revision is typically addition. It's not, the sentences come out pretty much how I want them to, but I will end up adding whole scenes or, moving things around. But
see, I would have thought the exact opposite.
Yeah.
Because, and especially this one story, I'm going to ask you to read the first paragraph, and that's the Lolita type scene.
Oh, yeah.
It's interesting what you left out.
Sure.
And I guess I imagined at some point you wrote this much longer story and then actually went in and edited and cut scenes that you felt maybe were giving too much away or weren't absolutely necessary.
I come from the point of almost nothing, and I have to work really hard to get. So I know some people write around and around and around and have, amass so many pages, and then they cut it down to be the sort of sharp thing. I'm like the opposite, where I'm sort of just desperately trying to elongate or expand however I can. But the individual sentences, I'm always sort of working and reworking off the page before I even sit down to write. So
every story in the book, except the last, is narrated in the first person. Mm-hmm. And I know you also said at the book festival that you're a first person present tense type of writer.
Yeah.
So getting the voice right is very important, especially for getting to know the main character in this, who's usually the narrator. So what's that process like, finding the right tone and the rhythm? I guess you would want to start with first person present tense, but you decided this last story would be third person. Some are first person past tense.
Yes. So I think first person present is... It's not really that I think of that I know which type of tense I'm going to use first. I mostly just am truly just listening for something that's going to give away through the cadence or rhythm or syntax something about the character. And then from that point, I can know even who's talking and who are they talking to and what room are they in and what is the story. And then usually when I hear a story, there's sort of an urgency behind it. And that urgency usually comes in first person present tense. So it's someone's telling me the story, right? And I'm sort of the conduit for the story. I know that sounds crazy, but...
Oh, not at all.
And so like the story Blacklight, the very first line is, Jesus, that's who. She found him on the basketball court. And and I just know that someone who's telling me, like, this is who broke my heart. This is what happened to me. And it's the urgency is the communication almost directly from the narrator to the reader. reminder, because that when you have first person present tense, it's I'm going to tell you something and here's what it is. And so they're all naturally telling those stories in that way. And then for the last story for Starlight, I knew because I needed to see her from the outside, because she's so literally out of her head in that story, but because of the drug use, but also just because of the circumstance, they've sort of walked out of their everyday life to go do this illicit thing together. And I knew I needed to see her from the outside. I also wanted to show her, because she's so up and down in her own head about it's the best time ever. Oh my God, it's the worst thing. This is awful. And I wanted to see a sort of a perspective a little bit from the outside so that as a reader, we could be like, I don't think she's having as much fun as she's pretending to be having.
I was looking for the quote there. I have it written down someplace where, boy, what does she say? Jill is the character there. She says, it's fun now, but it's going to get so bad.
It's going to get so bad, yeah.
I save for a little later for some of that self-awareness we were going to talk about where the characters, they realize things happening. They don't necessarily take it as a course of action,
yeah.
Unfortunately. Now, maybe we should give listeners a taste of how voice works in the stories. One of my favorites in the book is the one we talked about, The Light Will Pour In, with the older man and the much younger lover, Trish, in this Dallas motel room. And it's also the only story in the book with a male narrator, but which is interesting too. And I think you capture the voice just perfectly. But I wondered if you could just read that first paragraph.
Sure. She had her heart set on a coast. Didn't matter to her which one, but we'd started to limp in the slow middle of nowhere. We were down to sock money, and nothing was easy now that we'd left real life behind. We had turned our losses inward at each other, and now we fought, mostly on buses or at bus stations or on looping walks through hateful, sprawling towns looking for the terminal.
That is so beautiful.
Thank you.
And so musical. And I know you've said in previous interviews, you're not a professional musician, but you play an instrument.
Mm-hmm.
And you didn't say which one. Piano,
well,
guitar?
I grew up taking piano lessons. Uh-huh. I play, right now, honestly, I play an omnichord, which is this sort of, it's like an electric auto harp. So you're sort of, I strum it and you push the chords in. It's very lazy. You don't have to actually do much. You can just know some chords and play. But mostly, what I do constantly is sing all the time, in my car, on the street, in the shower, all the time, all day long. So.
And each story really is musical. I mean, you could tell there the way it kind of that paragraph kind of rises and then ends towards the end that about the terminal. And I know you've said in an interview that often you've got the music that you want to capture in the story, but you don't always have the right syllables or the right words.
Yeah.
And it reminded me of a famous story of how Paul McCartney wrote Yesterday.
Oh, right. Scrambled Eggs.
Yeah, Scrambled Eggs. He needed three syllables. He wasn't sure what they would be yet. So he had the melody. So it was Scrambled Eggs.
Yeah.
But you're like that too, where you've got the music and it's just a matter of getting the right words at the right syllable count?
Yeah. Or it will be some weird thing in my head where I know... this sounds so crazy. Like, I know that something needs to be very pointy. Like, I need T's and S's and
that's
I need
something. That's the way
something.
A lyricist works with
right?
a songwriter, right?
Yeah, and so I know that if I need something to be sort of, like, I'll have an image in my head of, like, the spiral of a snail shell or something crazy, and then I just know I need to, like, for that story, I wanted to get that swirl. And so in that first paragraph, it's how do you capture that, the swirl? And so the way you do it is this sort of, like, long loping walks, da 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 da. So it's almost like that. It starts just with the rhythm of the sentence, and then I know.
And it's not short sentences there. There's clauses there.
Yeah.
Which kind of...
Then you're just bringing it on, and also the idea of going to sleep and waking up and not knowing where you are and having the whole world remade. I think the next part's like the whole world is remade by sunlight, just not knowing where you are and being sort of like in a dark spiral, which is what their whole relationship is a dark spiral.
Yes. It all comes from what seems like a very tragic mistake.
Yeah.
Them running off. And,
yeah.
Now they're on the run and who knows what their future is going to be like, but he doesn't have high hopes.
No, I don't think she does either.
No. Now, another important theme in the book, besides the leitmotif, of course, the voice, the resiliency, and Texas,
yeah.
is the desire for something beyond the ordinary. beyond the dreary reality of a small town, a boring job, a relationship, a dysfunctional family, and they all are kind of normality in some of the stories, or a cheap motel room, as in the story we talked about, and also the last story in the book. Now, in that last story, Starlight, you write, there's another world underneath this one, easy enough to get to. And then it's like we're lifting the, what is it Jill said, is scrim a word? You could slip right out of your life. Now, that word scrim also came up at the book festival. I didn't quite understand at the time. You mentioned using scrim when writing fiction. Is there a connection here between your use of scrim in the story and what you were getting at the book festival?
I think it's just this idea that there's, that you're always operating in at least two levels, at least two, where there's what you're saying and there's what you're, there's the language that you're conveying to the reader. There's the craft that's going in that you hope that the reader doesn't see. And then there's the meaning that's below that, that's somehow beyond both of those. And so this idea of a scrim, or this idea of like working underneath a blanket, almost like not having everything visible even to you as you're doing it, if that makes any sense.
Oh, okay. So you're trying to hide the craft there and maybe not be too overt with what you're getting across.
Not be too overt, but also even that it's not even that I'm trying to hide it. It's that I don't often notice it until, I mean, sometimes you're starting from I'm never starting from an idea or a plot. Like I'm never saying I want to write about two lovers in a hotel room, but sometimes I might be like, I want to write about a spiral, or I want to write about this shape. And like, that's where I could start from. But even then I'm still sort of moving around in the dark quite a bit until I figure it out.
And figuring it out is getting that first sentence.
Yeah, right? The first sentence.
Because that gives you the voice.
Yeah, it's like the tear. It's the tear in the scrim.
In the scrim.
To see.
Wow. Yeah.
That makes sense.
Yeah, what a great way of looking at it.
Yeah.
Now, in that story, that same story, so the lovers are Jill and Rick, and mm-hmm. they're, as we mentioned, they're spending the day away from work. They've got a lot of cocaine. They've got some fast food. They've got mixtape.
Do you need?
Yeah. Right. And it's a kind of a rundown motel in Houston called the Starlight.
Starlight.
And in a great interview you did with Alex Baer, who is a Portland writer, that was Propeller. I think it was my favorite one of the interviews
I love that interview
researched.
As well.
Yeah, you said in that one, Kim, with the drug stuff, sex stuff, deprivation, they're all trying to figure out different ways to experience the world because they believe there's something else going on underneath the everyday. They're always trying to get to that deeper place. And also in that interview, you added sex and drugs both heighten the senses, heighten intimacy, and I like all that stuff. There's not that much difference between kids playing games and grown-ups doing drugs in hotel rooms. It's just escapism. How do we get out of this world? And that's what that's still your quote. So it's interesting what readers might see as kind of the tawdry, the drugs, and the sex in the story you present as a positive. It's a way for the characters to bring light into their lives. A sleazy motel room can become, in effect, a low-rent paradise, however temporary, and it's not something they seem to want to leave.
No, and I think it's the same way, you know, it's playing at a different life, and that's play. It's still play, and there's curiosity, and also the idea of drug use when we're talking about recreational drug use and not necessarily like habitual, you know, physical dependency, but you're talking about someone who's like, what's going to happen? This could be really fun. Like, let's go see. And this isn't something that we do every day. This is something that we're going to go do specially for the, you know, today we're going to go to this motel room and do this thing. Or can you do that? Can you can you slip out of your normal life and then walk into something that is tawdry and, you know, and you get to slum it in that motel room. She loves that you rent it by the hour. She thinks it's great. She's got somebody watering her plants and walking her dogs at her beautiful right. home, not so far away. But this idea of play is fun. And it's what my kids do. You know, they want to have a kitchen made out of boxes. We have an actual kitchen in our home, but they want this, you know, you want to just have these little sets. And that's what a hotel room is as well. It's a set.
And in your stories, you have both. You have kids playing games. In mm-hmm. one story, there's a little girl sets up a kind of a camping tent in her living room.
Absolutely.
And her mother's narrating the story. Mm-hmm. And you also have, what's the one, Duck Duck?
Yeah, Duck Duck Brick.
Brick. They're actually throwing bricks at each other.
Throwing bricks and rocks, yeah. These little feral suburban kids who are everyone's just trying to make sense of or there's just genuine playfulness happening. And there's can still be genuine playfulness happening when it's adults doing drug stuff or sex stuff. It's still play. It can be.
And it's that light. It's that kind of escape from the mundane, what we would consider normal.
Yeah.
And that becomes almost a bad word in some of the stories.
Sure, yeah.
Now, in your stories and interviews, I want to talk a little bit about the drugs. You talk about psychedelic drugs in a positive way as a way to experience a different reality. I know you're working on a novel.
Yes.
that has motherhood, Texas, and LSD in
yes.
there. Now, in the story Glow Hunter, the narrator is hunting for psilocybin mushrooms with her friend Bo, who's that very charismatic mm-hmm. person. The light is coming out of her. And she says Bo is always dangling new universes, places she says are hidden in plain sight. She tells me not to worry, that with mushrooms we'll be us, only better. Imagine everything slightly dazzling, she says, real life. With a glow. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about your take on psychedelics and those experiences that kind of take us out of this everyday world and maybe how they work in your fiction.
Sure. So as a my own personal human experience with psychedelics is that I have used them to positive effect, hugely positive, long-lasting, self-esteem building, connection with family and friends, and not the people who are even in the room with me when I'm saying this, just that I've had experiences where I've felt very accepting and empathetic towards people that I might not otherwise because of directly in response to the use of psychedelics. And again, it's not something for every day, perhaps, but this is something that, and as a younger person, this is a past life prior to my children. But something that was meaningful, deeply meaningful and positive and long-lasting positive effects came from it. So I feel like I make better, more interesting art because of it, or my thoughts are different, thoroughly changed by the use of psychedelics. And so I like to write characters who are also either open to that experience or who are, I mean, I feel like all of my characters are looking for the same things that psychedelics can give you a shortcut to, which is the experience of reality, altered reality. That's it. And so.
And also connection.
And connection.
And that empathy that you found.
And not only connection with the people that you're with, but connection to the universe, or, you know.
Right. That's almost huge. The stereotype about drugs like LSD.
Right.
You just feel that everything is connected.
And it's like
you're not
cliche.
That individual on your own.
Right. Total obliteration of the ego, all of those things, which I find to be what a lot of my characters want. And so, yeah, in the novel, the themes don't run that far away from the themes that are present in Blacklight, for sure.
I want to get back to the self-awareness, and it's really interesting how self-aware they are. And we mentioned some of the statements, this is fun now, but it's going to get so bad. And that, the neon light for the character in the hotel room saying, let her go, but he's not quite willing to do that with Trish yet. Now, they know any escape offered through drugs, sex, dreams, deprivation can't last. I think that's the self-awareness. In Starlight, that last one, Rick, who's one of the lovers, and he's having sex and doing coke in the motel room, he says, I don't want to go back to normal, he said. But normal was always there waiting. Never has normal felt so foreboding. And I think I mentioned earlier, it's almost like a bad thing in the book. But really, the characters, their normal lives are not that happy.
No, they're not necessarily. I mean, I'm thinking of both. Like when we think of the office setting, I guess we have Jill and Rick who are in an office. We don't know what their business is exactly, but we know
Rick,
her supervisor.
Rick is Jill's boss. Yeah.
Yeah, and then we know that in Guts, the narrator is in a. I think it's like a title company. She's doing something with real estate and she's a receptionist. And there's this sort of like this crushing boredom, I think, that all of them are experiencing, which is just this idea of the day-to-day. I think, in Starlight, Jill's so happy to be away from her paper shredder. Like just this idea of getting something different. I think it's about breaking routine. And it's not necessarily that their lives are so terrible. I mean, Jill has a great life. Rick has probably a pretty good life, you know? But this idea that, you get tired of things or you want something that dazzles, something that's a little bit more sparkly than your day-to-day life. So I think that's what they're doing is they're trying to do that. And then in terms of being self-aware, I think they're all very self-aware. Even the children are pretty self-aware. The thing about making bad decisions, you can... I've never made a bad decision that I didn't know was a bad decision. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
That doesn't mean that I didn't make it. I still made it. It's just that you everything does seem to be pretty, they're pretty self-aware, and that doesn't mean that they can control their desires or that they can undercut all of those things.
And maybe they wouldn't want to, yeah. As in your own experience, you make that bad decision, but there must be something positive about the decision that's yeah. letting you go ahead, even though you know the consequences might not be the most positive result.
Yeah, everything is just, I mean, I think there's this part, the one thing that I'm most grateful for in my life is curiosity. And curiosity gets you in trouble, of course. And there are plenty of things where, like, what would happen if I did this? And knowing, I mean, when I was a kid, one of the things I did I think I was 10 years old, I used to go down this hill every day on my bike. And every day I would think, what if I put my foot in the spokes? And every day I wouldn't do it until the day that I did do it. And what happens is exactly what I suspected might happen, which is I flipped over the handlebars and I broke the orbit, the bone that holds your eye in place. My dad had to come pick me up and my whole face was swollen. It was a huge, big, horrible thing. And yet, I didn't learn my lesson from that. I have always had low impulse control as a person. But some of the best things have happened to me because of that willingness to do something.
Out of the ordinary.
I'm not saying that I'm happy that I broke my eye bone, but I'm saying that there's something about that moment that at least... I mean, I don't know. It's very on brand for me as a human being.
You don't seem to regret it.
No, I don't. I don't. Even just for the story. But it's also a strange thing to explain to someone how you know it's going to hurt or it's going to be bad. It's not a great decision. You're pretty sure you know. But like maybe what if I had flown? What if I didn't fall? What if instead I soared up into the sky? I don't know. I just want to keep all my options open.
Now, you mentioned your childhood in Texas then, yeah. And you know, sticking your foot in the yeah. spokes. So you grew up in Lubbock, Texas, yeah. And I mentioned it's the birthplace of Buddy Holly, mm-hmm. And there's at least one story in the book that takes place in Lubbock called The Soft No, and you even mentioned there's a statue, which I looked up, and that's true.
Yes, there he is.
Now, you've said about your hometown, I understand that feeling of feeling wrong in a space. That's how I felt growing up, removed, just wrong, wrong-bodied, wrong-minded, wrong everything. And so the body is a fast way to get to that sensation in fiction. How do you get to that sensation in these stories? And are there some elements you've taken from your own childhood? There's not one story in here where the character puts her foot in the spoke.
No.
Maybe later.
Maybe later. Yeah, I think it is. It's that feeling of the things that are okay or acceptable for everyone else are not okay or acceptable for me. Or like I can't just... you know, even thinking about Jill and her paper shredder at work, this idea of like, you should just go to work. Everyone goes to work. You go to work and you go home and it should be fine. And you should be grateful to have the job. But just this feeling of this nagging feeling of, I don't want to do this. I don't want to do it this way. I don't want to do it your way. There's a different way or there's something else. Isn't there? This idea of there's got to be something underneath, something better or different. And I've always had that feeling, even when I was a little kid living in, you know, whether it was in Lubbock or being in my grandma's house or later in Dallas. And Plano, this sensation of there's something else happening somewhere else. So I've always felt that way. And some of it's probably wrapped up in queer desire, I'm sure. Just being like, I think I'm experiencing the world in a way that's maybe different than some of my friends and some of my peers. And also not being able to really articulate what that meant even, because not having really an example to point at.
But you have characters in here that are similar.
Yeah, I do. And it took me a while. And I think it even took me, you know, a long time to understand. Yeah, the thing about being like bisexual or, you know, or queer. I prefer the term queer just because it's sort of all encompassing. But is that you're not gay, because that's one thing. And then you can come out and be that and that's your thing. But this sort of back and forth or the sort of, oh, now when I'm with this person, this presents as a heteronormative relationship. And when I'm with this person, now I'm presenting as a homosexual relationship. And I'm always the same person, whether I'm with this person or that person. But it's sort of that that flow or that difference that I think makes you feel maybe different in a space. Which, you know,
especially if that space is Lubbock, Texas.
Yeah,
that's not really friendly there. And the main character actually in that story, the Soft No, is in a similar situation. Or not the Soft No, but Black Light.
Black Light. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the sort of conservative, Christian conservative, small town. You know. Yeah, all of those judgmental stuff. Yeah, I'm sure you're like, even to the point where I wasn't quite sure how to articulate that there. You know. So yeah, I think it takes time to get away from it.
And again, at the Portland Book Festival, you talked about your love for Amy Hempel's short fiction, yep. and I read her blurb on the book earlier in the introduction, and how you try to follow her advice. The advice is you want a short story to punch you in the heart at the end, and you do that beautifully throughout the book. I mean, some incredible last paragraphs and sentences that just leave me, you know, aghast.
Thank you.
My jaw hanging slack. And so I don't want to give any endings away, since that might lighten the effect of the punch there that a reader would get. But can you talk about how you achieve that effect? I'm thinking especially about the stories Foxes, Into the Fold, and even Starlight, which is not quite a punch, a strong punch, but it's there.
And
that's their desire not to go back to the normal world, which isn't all that bad, but this is their escape from it.
Yeah, I think so. The if we talk about the opening sentence as being sort of a gut feeling, the ending is the same for me. So it's at a certain point in the construction, I come to the last sentence, and sometimes that's very early. Sometimes that's you write the first paragraph and then you know exactly what the line is. And it's then creating a whole world and characters and dialogue and people and setting to get you to that line. And so sometimes that happens, or sometimes you're almost done and you're like, I have no idea how to stop this without sucking. Like, that's the goal, right? Just how to stop it without being terrible. And then something comes to you. I think with Foxes, that line, which I'm not going to say, but okay. Getting to that line was, okay, I know what she's been doing the whole time. Mm-hmm. And it's just sort of stating a fact that sometimes it's just stating something simple. But then once you say it at the end, after going through the length of the story, it's sort of freighted with meaning, you know?
And that was a story you've actually said that you started back in 2005 and didn't finish till 2017.
Yeah.
And that's where I guess you added some stuff from what you said, but it didn't make the final cut. And that was backstories on the little girl in there. The little girl actually started out as some boys.
Yeah.
And then some mute children.
Yeah.
And then you had a backstory on the kind of missing father there.
Yeah.
It's a single mom raising her daughter, and the father is kind of mentioned in the story, but he's not in it directly.
And I would say, like, when she, it was there, the girl was a boy at first, and then she was two boys and three. Yeah, like there was sort of a changing of who was the child, but there was still not really, there wasn't really backstory, because I'm incapable of writing backstory, but there was just a different, the triangulation was different, or like the charge in that room was different, because when it's a daughter, a mother and a daughter is a different charge than, you know, a mother and two sons or, you know, whatever. And so it took me a while. And also, she's a particular type of daughter. You know, she's a troubled daughter, and she's a bloody minded daughter. And it took me a while to realize that. But once I did, the rest of it sort of fell into place. But yeah, that story was a real pain to write, because I wrote a version of it that was an acceptable version for years.
You've said that it just felt wrong, though.
Yeah.
You kept looking at it. I think the crowning moment was you checked into an Airbnb.
And, yeah, just, in Austin.
And you had a deadline.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. It's funny. I'm like, how fortunate that I figured it out before my deadline. But it's like, obviously, the deadline is why I figured it out.
I love deadlines.
Right? Oh, me too. Me too. I went to the Airbnb, and I was just doing the final revisions, and nobody had said to me, the story's messed up, you need to fix it. But I knew there was something wrong with it. And then sitting in that room, I spread it out on the floor and looked at it, and I realized, okay, I can do this different thing and put the daughter's story actually in the
And that was that there. Gut punch, actually.
Yeah, and then that's when I realized I'd been missing that whole part of it. It just did something. I mean, and I don't know, like, that's necessarily, like, the solution, but, you know, this writing is always about sort of following your own rules and playing this weird logic games with yourself, and so now it feels right. And no one published it before, and I had sent it, to a few places and had some positive feedback, but no one took it. And then I was just, it seems very fortunate that they didn't. Now, looking at the scope, because it ended up being now at the Paris Review, and that's the story that was supposed to be that way, and it needed to be told in that particular way. And so luckily I didn't give up on it.
Now, I'm very fortunate that you're here today. You must be exhausted. At the Portland Book Festival, Kim, you did three sessions and that pop-up reading.
Yeah.
And starting back in August, you've been all over the country. You've done with the Mississippi Book Fair, lots of interviews, lots of readings, bookstore events. And I wondered, after all that, you're back home now. Was there any particular question or comment from the audience from one of these events that really stuck with you?
You know, my son came to the Powell's launch. I wanted my kids to see what
and that was back in August.
August, yeah, that was I think it was the second one because I started in Seattle. But so I wanted them to see. You know, I've been doing this for a dozen years, and since certainly for their whole lives. I have a 6-year-old and an 8-year-old, and I wanted them to see what it is I've been up to and like what this is what mom does. So I wanted them to come. And so they came to the event, and you know, there's a crowd and they're sitting there, and my son asked a question during the Q&A, and he said, you know, I see him raising his hand and I'm like, should I call on him or what? And he said, now that you've finished writing books, are you happy or are you a little bit depressed? and I loved it because it's great on two levels. One is, I am not finished writing books, sir. Because, you know, he's like, great, you're done with that. So now you can play with us more. And touche. Yeah. You know, it's like, I am. I'm a little bit depressed. You know, there's a feeling of, you know, I'm happy, I'm excited. But then, of course, there's that strange feeling of being, it's out of your hands. And at that point, you know, that was the second tourist thing that I had done. And I didn't know. You never know. I've seen beautiful books get completely ignored. Some of my favorite writers are writers who aren't necessarily the writers that are being read by everyone, you know, and to me, they're huge. And I think about them all the time. And I walk around with lines of theirs in my head. But so you never know what's going to happen. But I liked that question.
And it's probably not a question you'd get from anybody else.
No.
But a family member, right?
Yeah.
Now, most of your stories, as I mentioned, take place in Texas, usually small towns. And I think you know her, Karen Russell, who lives in Portland. And I interviewed her a few months ago for Between the Covers. Her latest book is Orange World. So her childhood home is Florida.
Yeah.
And almost all of her fiction up until Orange World took place in Florida. But she had at least two stories in there, including the title story, Orange World, that takes place in Portland, mm-hmm. or the environs. There's one that takes place in a fictional Mount Hood area.
I love that.
Do you find yourself making a similar geographical relocation in your newer work from Texas to Portland or Oregon?
Well, not yet. In the new story, in the novel, the narrator is in New York, like someone we know. I lived in New York for 13 years in between Texas and here. She lives in New York, and then she has to go back home because of a family emergency, and home is Texas. So
Lubbock, Texas, or a fictionalized small town.
I think kind of a panhandle town, which is probably more like where my grandparents live, like in Kitty Quay area is where she's going back to. But so try as I might, I can't seem to get out of Texas. But we'll see. I have a couple of – there was a story I wrote about California – having never been to California, actually, when I wrote it, which is hilarious. but I think Texas has a pretty strong pull. So
maybe a stronger pull than Florida has.
Yeah.
Well, Kimberly King Parsons, again, thanks so much for talking with us today on Between the Covers.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been really, really fun. Thank you.
We've been talking with Kimberly King Parsons, author of the story collection Black Light from Vintage Books. You can learn more about Kim and her work on KimberlyKingParsons.com. I'm Ken Jones, and this has been Between the Covers on KABU Community Radio. Many thanks to Kim for visiting us at KABU, and to all of you for listening.